Welcome back to Word on the Hills with me, Gwyn Sheltimer, my co-host Felicity Signal-Reed, and our guest this week, Peggy Diamond Levy. And Peggy is here this week talking about her latest biography about Molly Brandt. Now, Molly is somebody that I don't know very much about. Perhaps you could tell us a little about Molly's life and how she came to be so influential, why she makes good topic for a book.
I think she probably makes good topic for a book because there was so little written about her. She was born in 1736 in Mohawk Valley. She was born into a poor family. Probably that we wouldn't have heard anything about her until she attracted the eye of William Johnson, the influential 18th century white man. Now, William Johnson had relationships with other Mohawk women. He was a fur trader and a farmer, and he was always ingratiating himself into the Mohawk society because, you know, to win mm-hmm. more influence with them. And so, as I said, he had earlier liaisons with Mohawk women, but Molly was different in that she actually was the first one who became part of his life. She was part of his whole life. He was superintendent of Indian Affairs, and in his absence, he trusted her so much that she took over running the department when he was away.
Well, especially in that time, that would have been quite something.
Exactly. She was also very active in the Iroquois Society, and she's credited with keeping her people, the Mohawk people, on the side of the British during the American Revolution. And for that reason, too, she was blamed by her people for the loss of their homeland. She and her brother Joseph were blamed so that they didn't want to talk about Molly Brandt up here. Mm-hmm. In fact, when I first made inquiries about her, she was sort of persona non grata, definitely in Tanandaneega. Joseph was. They felt a little bit gentler towards Molly. So it was difficult to find a lot of information about her.
So do you think that's why she's been in obscurity for so long?
That's part of the problem, yes. And then Aboriginal history was an oral history, so there wasn't anything written down for a long, long time. It's only fairly recently that we're hearing of Aboriginal writers, and society has changed so much that we want to hear that. It's part of our history. So that was part of it, for the blame for losing the Mohawk homelands. And the histories that were written in those days were written by white males, and they looked on Molly Brandt as nothing more really than, you know, a concubine. Wow. Some of them, you know, were quite disparaging about her. Some of them even thought because she'd had influence over Sir William's life and his private life and everything, they figured, oh, this, she must be a witch.
Oh, so that does not bode well.
No.
Well, at least she's being celebrated now because the series that you write for is about, to quote Dundurn, Canadian heroines.
That's right.
Right. So it's quite a turnaround.
Yeah. Well, she was recognized in, I think, 1985 by Canada as a person of national historic interest. So, and then the fact that she was the only woman with her name on the founding charter of St. George's Anglican Cathedral in Kingston, the United Empire Loyalist Association put up a plaque in that church. So her story is being known from things like that. There's a statue, a bust of her likeness at Rideau Crest Home, which is the site of where she lived, where her house was, a house built for her by the Canadian government in gratitude. There is now a nursing home there, and they put up a beautiful cairn with a bust of her on the top. It's quite lovely. In fact, that's the cover of my book is that sculpture.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. Let me tell you about discovering when I went. I figured that Tiendanega Mohawk Library would be the place to go. They call it Kanhihoti. And while I was there, I discovered, in fact, I remember this happening. A few years ago, they had a Mohawk writer, Beth Brandt, come and do a series of interviews with the Mohawk elders living there. And one of the elders told Beth Brandt that back in the 1920s, there was a white woman teaching school there at the Tiendanega Public School. And she was writing a thesis at the time of Molly Brandt. Oh, well, actually, he said that she was writing a book about Molly Brandt. So I found out who she was, and I tracked it down through the archives at Queen, because apparently Molly Brandt had been the topic of her master's thesis. But she also was writing a book of Molly Brandt. She had all this information. She had spent summers up in Ottawa of the National Archives, going right back to the Haldimand papers, the Claus papers, and Sir William Johnson's letters, things like that. Wow. She had done a tremendous amount of work. But her manuscript was destroyed in a fire when she was teaching school later in Oil Springs, Ontario. So, and she never felt well enough. She had ill health for a lot of her life. She never felt well enough to rewrite it. But these, her research notes and her thesis were still in at Queen's.
Oh, what a gem.
Yes, I know.
Absolutely. Well, perhaps you could read a little more for us from Molly Brandt.
I would love to.
Well, she'd probably give its correct title, Molly Brandt, Mohawk, Loyalist, and Diplomat.
Details of where Molly Brandt was born and who her father was remain sketchy at best. The year of her birth, most generally accepted, is 1736. Authorities agree that her mother's name was Margaret, or Awanda, and that both her parents were Christian Mohawks living in the village of Canajoharie, one of the two main Mohawk villages in central New York State. At Molly's birth, her parents gave her the Mohawk name Gonwatsijeyeni, meaning someone lends her a flower. In English, she was known as Mary, or more often, Molly. In March 1743, while 7-year-old Molly and her family were away from home on what may have been an extending hunting expedition to the Ohio Valley, Margaret gave birth to a son. She and her husband, Peter, named the child Theundenegia, which means two sticks, or he who places two bets in Mohawk. He later became better known by his Christian name, Joseph. By 1750, most Canajoharie people had been baptized in the Anglican Church. Margaret and her husband Peter were listed in the Register of Anglican Mohawks as Protestant Christians. Sometime in the 1740s, Peter died, possibly during one of the widespread cholera or influenza epidemics that claimed the lives of many native people who were in contact with the Europeans. Along with their guns, ammunition, and rum, the Europeans brought with them new diseases for which the indigenous people had no immunity. Widowed, Margaret returned with Molly and Joseph to Canajoharie, where they could expect to find shelter among members of her clan, according to Iroquois custom. In Canajoharie, the widow Margaret discovered that food was scarce among her people, and she was forced to find a way to provide for herself and her two children, working at whatever small jobs she could find, but the family was often faced with starvation. She may well have joined in the liquor trade, and most certainly would have enlisted the children to help her dig for ginseng root. Ginseng could be exchanged for food and supplies at the trading posts and forts. There was a lucrative market in China for the medicinal root that grew wild in the Mohawk Valley. On September the 9th, 1753, Margaret married Brant Canagarradunca, whose wife had recently died. Several years older than Margaret, Brant was a wealthy Mohawk sachem from the Turtle Clan, living in Ticonderoga. He had a son, Nicus, from his earlier marriage. Brant lived in a large two-story house and dressed in the style of a white man. His clothing and the furniture in his home were said to be the equal of those of a middle-class European. There is some suggestion that he may have had some non-native ancestry, possibly Dutch. Molly was a teenager and Joseph about 10 when Brant built Margaret and the children a big house in Canajoharie, the best house in town, with a stone foundation, glass in the windows, and interior walls of plaster. A prosperous man with important connections to white traders and government officials, Brant was also a kind and considerate father. Whenever he returned from his business dealings with the white man, he brought presents home for his stepchildren. Life was now much easier for the family than it had been. No longer was it a constant struggle to find enough food to satisfy their bellies. Because of the relationship with Brant, Margaret and her children were raised to a higher level in the eyes of Iroquois society, and Molly and Joseph took as their surname the name of their stepfather. While she was growing up, many of Molly's neighbors were white settlers. One of those neighbors and a frequent visitor to the home of Margaret and Brant Canegaradunka was William Johnson, who lived on the edge of Mohawk Territory west of Schenectady. A wealthy landowner, farmer, and fur trader, William Johnson was always on the lookout for opportunities to connect with the Mohawk people in order to increase his influence among them. And in 1746, New York Governor George Clinton had put him in charge of Indian affairs. He had won the confidence of the natives through his fair treatment of them, and the Mohawk came to prefer dealing with him than with the merchants and traders in Albany. Johnson respected the native culture. He learned the Mohawk language, joined them in their sporting events, and sometimes even wore Mohawk clothing. In return, the Mohawk adopted him as a brother, giving him the name Warageaji, meaning he who does much business. At 6 feet in height, William Johnson was a tall man for his time and athletically built, with dark eyes and complexion. Described by some as a man's man, William also enjoyed reading and used to order books from London for his personal library. The study of science, especially astronomy, was one of his many interests. It wasn't long before Brant Canegaradunka's attractive stepdaughter caught the eye of Sir William Johnson. There appears to have been a mutual attraction between the couple, and in 1759, Molly, who was 23, and William, in his mid-40s, began living together as husband and wife. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Yes, and what history, too. I'm really amazed when you consider that we're talking about a period that's, you know, coming on for 300 years ago, that you have such, you know, minute details about it. That's wonderful. It really brings history alive.
I hope so.
So thanks for joining us today, Peggy. We've been talking to Peggy Diamond Levy about her new book, Molly Brant, Mohawk, Loyalist, and Diplomat. If you'd like to go to one of Peggy's launches and hear her read from the book, perhaps buy the book there, check the Dundurn website, which is dundurn.com, for details of where they will be. And if you'd like to connect with us, please send your comments, queries, or suggestions to wordonthehills897@gmail.com. And please visit us, too, at our website, wordonthehills.com. There you'll find all previous programs archived, and you can listen to them anytime and anywhere. So thanks for tuning in today. I hope you'll join us again next week, Sunday at 1 p.m., right here on Northumberland 897, Truly Local Radio.